Good afternoon from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. This is Airtime, extended conversations with interesting people.
Our whole vision is that we're pushing on the biggest levers we can find and wielding the power that exists in and from Aspen.
Nobel laureate in physics Arthur Ashkin talks about winning the Nobel Prize 4 decades after his invention, the world's smallest tweezers.
I can manipulate a single atom, pick it up, look at it, put it down.
And Beth Klein, a lawyer who has dedicated her career to fighting human trafficking and child abuse in Colorado.
When you drive by your middle school, that's where most of the kids are getting picked off.
Thanks for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio's new show, Airtime. Stay tuned. The Aspen Skiing Company released its annual sustainability report last week in comic book format. Reporter Zoe Rome spoke with Auden Schendler, Senior Vice President of Sustainability, about the report and the impact of the company's role in climate change mitigation.
Our goal is to educate our employees and customers and the public about our philosophy and about where we came from and what we're trying to do. So we said, well, what about a comic book? You know, our past issues have been really information dense. What if we distilled it to almost nothing and just tried to get the message across?
What trade-offs are you making when you represent it in kind of a more digestible format as opposed to something that is harder to read but is a bit more substantive?
There's the risk of seeming lightweight. What we do is we link the hard data on carbon to our website. Essentially, we're saying, look, we're as serious as anybody, but our goal here is to convey some basic information about what we're doing.
You guys mentioned that you banned plastic straws this year. I'm wondering, what are other areas you guys are really looking to cut down in that are maybe a little bit less flashy?
The comment about plastic straws was a joke that got exactly at what you're saying, which is it doesn't really matter. These are things that don't really do much, but we do them to keep people going and to keep people enthusiastic. You know, even a cynic like myself has realized these are important things as we work on the much, much bigger, much more important issues like how do we get our utility to produce more clean energy? How do we get state policy aligned? How do we push on national policy? Our whole vision is that we're pushing on the biggest levers we can find and wielding the power that exists in and from Aspen. But we're always going to do little things that people can understand so that, frankly, so they can wake up in the morning in the face of real significant environmental challenges like climate change and still feel that we're moving forward.
So in terms of your goals of reducing carbon emissions, Holy Cross Energy is the utility producer that you guys depend on, and they're the ones that were moving towards more sustainable energy. Is there anything that you guys are doing other than just depending on the utility producer?
We have a long-term partnership and relationship with Holy Cross. So one project we've done is we invested almost $6 million in a coal mine methane plant that supplies Holy Cross with 3 megawatts of baseload power and deleted 4% of their carbon footprint. So we have a real on-the-ground concrete and iron partnership. But we've also worked to encourage and support progressive candidates for the board. We've done this for about 15 years. You'll notice the board is very, very progressive, maybe the most progressive in the United States. And you'll notice also that the new CEO of Holy Cross is a climate scientist. That didn't just happen.
At the end of the report, there's a little postcard that people can send to Senator Rob Portman. You guys are footing the bill for that postage-wise. How much do you guys anticipate spending on that?
Well, there are 1 million out there that could be sent, and our finance people are a little concerned about that. But unfortunately, most of those probably won't be sent, probably. It's in the tens of thousands of dollars.
There was a lot about the history of Aspen and the Aspen idea. How did that influence and guide this document?
Aspen can be perceived as this playground for the rich, but the truth about the history of Aspen is that Walter and Elizabeth Pepke had this vision that it could be a place to transform people and send them off to improve the world. We're seeing that as a way that our resort can be meaningful in doing more than just selling lift tickets. Tying back into that history, I think, is really an important part of our understanding of who we are.
Is there a specific example you can give of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you come ski at one of our hills, you're going to be exposed to art. You're going to be exposed to climate change information. You might be disturbed by some of the messaging you get. That's part of our goal. We don't want to ruin your vacation, but we want to really enrich it by exposing you to things beyond just your ski experience that make you think, that push you out of your usual life and enable you to go back as a different and better person.
What do you think is the biggest positive stride in terms of sustainability that SkiCo has made in the past year?
You know, I think we've made a realization that Aspen can be criticized for being a center of conspicuous consumption. People might legitimately ask, well, how can you even talk about sustainability? But I think the answer to that is, this is exactly where we should be working on sustainability, because this is a center of power and of influence. These are the people, and this is the name that can get the recognition and the power and has access to the influence to drive the change we need. This is precisely where we ought to be working on climate. And so our Give a Flake marketing campaign, which reached out to senators and got responses from those senators, is a really exciting change. And I think you're going to see other businesses increasingly do this.
Where do you see the most room for improvement in 2019?
Honestly, we want to see the trade groups take leadership on climate. The heads of the big ski industry trade groups haven't spoken out and said, this is a big issue, it's a huge concern, and we want to make it a priority for our organizations. We're pushing really, really hard internally to change that.
Right, but like, what is SkiCo doing for that?
We are pushing really, really hard inside these organizations, saying you have to lead and use your voice so that you can bring an entire industry along as a social movement, as a political force to drive big scale change on climate.
That was Zoe Rome speaking with Auden Schindler, Senior Vice President of Sustainability for the Aspen Skiing Company. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, the conversations, questions, and issues that deserve more time. Nobel laureate and physicist Arthur Ashkin won the Nobel Prize in Physics last year for his optical tweezers, microscopic beams of light that can pick up and move tiny objects, like cells and atoms. Zoe Rome caught up with him about the discovery and its lasting impacts.
Suppose you have a little piece of a glass sphere on the floor, okay? You can reach down with your two fingers and pick it up. That's called trapping and manipulation. I trap it between my two fingers. I lift it up. I look at it. I find out how big it is, how small it is, what color it is. Okay, that's trapping and manipulation.
So your optical tweezers,
all right,
correct?
Now I do this for biological particles. What's a biological particle? You know what a virus is, what a bacterium is, what a little animal is, small animals, you know, paramecium, single cells. Do you look at an onion cell?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I can pick up an onion cell. I can look into the cell and manipulate its guts. So that's what trapping. So it's a very powerful technique.
Right. Why is it so important?
You mean you don't know why an atom is important? There are only 97, 96 elements.
Right.
And every single disease is caused by a bug or a virus. Don't you want to know about these?
Yeah.
Or you want to just suffer there and die?
I do want to know, but how did the optical tweezers, what did those teach us about those things?
Well, I can pick them up and I can examine each one. I can tell you what it does and what chemicals it uses and what it takes to kill it, what it takes to make it alive. All right. Everything that you is practically ever known about these things. Well, what about DNA? It's got all the genes and genetic information within it, all right? And it tells you if you're going to have blue eyes or green eyes. It tells you whether you're going to be tall or short. So it has all the genetic information. Well, you can learn all of that with tweezers, all right? And you can manipulate it. By manipulating it, you can pick it up and you can find out what's doing and so on, okay?
How do you make tweezers out of lasers? That's light, right?
Well, light can capture things. Now, that's the very first discovery. Do you know that light has heat, energy? It shines on you and heats you up, right? Now, next question is, do you know that the light is pushing on you?
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that, but I know that. If you shine light on something, you know, light is made up of little balls of energy. They're called photons. Now, suppose I shoot a photon at you and it hits you. Isn't that going to give you a push? Suppose I throw a baseball at you very fast and it hits you. It could knock you over, right?
I think so.
All right, so a photon can push on you too. Now, I didn't discover that. Einstein discovered that. But did you know that you can take a laser beam and push on something? That's my discovery. But you know, the other great miracle is that not only can you push on something, you can trap it. Now, if I throw a medicine ball at you and I hit you, I'll knock you down, but I won't trap you, will I?
No.
But I have figured out how to trap particles, that if I take a light beam and shine it on a particle, I can trap it. That means I can grab it with a light beam and pick it up and look at it.
How does it feel to get the Nobel Prize after all these years?
How? Well, the present committee is not the same as the old committee. The present committee is a lot smarter. They see that I can use tweezers to make what I call a tweezer trap. That's with one beam, I can manipulate a thing, pick it up, look at it, put it down, and the one thing can be a single atom. It can be a single virus, a single bacterium, a single small animal.
Do you know of any specific discoveries that your invention has led to? Because a lot of other science depends on this.
All atomic physicists are using it. All biologists are using it.
Do you know of something specific we have learned because of?
Yes, how to cure disease or how to decide what is going to kill you and what is not. Suppose you have malaria. Not a good disease, right?
Right.
How do you know you have malaria? I pick up a little blood cell. Well, I pick up a single one of your red blood cells in my little trap. Now, when I look at, pick it up, if it starts to spin, you have malaria. If it doesn't spin, you're healthy.
I have to let you go, but I truly, truly appreciate both the work you've done in this field and the time that you've taken to speak to me so thoughtfully today, Mr. Ashkin.
That was Zoe Rome speaking with Nobel laureate and physicist Arthur Ashkin. You are listening to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio, a show that allows a little more time with the astounding people and ideas that come through our valley. Beth Klein is a human rights lawyer from Boulder, Colorado. She started the all-woman law firm, Frank and Klein, which works to combat human trafficking by working with communities to draft legislation. She's dedicated her career to working for and with survivors of trafficking and abuse.
How prevalent is the issue in this community?
Well, it's hard to measure. I mean, human trafficking in terms of sex trafficking is an under-the-radar kind of a crime. We know that there's labor trafficking issues with people who are not documented, with people who also have the ability to work in this country. There are a lot of agricultural jobs here in this community that are not really jobs. They take advantage of people. They control where they go, what they do, and they limit their access to communication, health, well-being, and education. The only way to solve this is to raise awareness and really raise compassion for all people.
What specific challenges does combating human trafficking present on the Western Slope?
We don't have a lot of people here. There are labor needs. There's cheap labor. That's one of the challenges. Law enforcement is not as prevalent as it would be in Denver, Boulder, Colorado Springs. We don't have an FBI task force here. Just getting over the mountain passes and getting into federal court and getting the assets that you need up here, those are the challenges that we have right now. It's resourcing up law enforcement, but more importantly, it's resourcing up education, keeping kids in school, and raising the economic picture for employers and farmers and ranchers and everybody here. It's really about bringing a great economy here that will solve a lot of problems.
So you've talked about some solutions in terms of economy and law enforcement. Is there anything that community members can do or should know about human trafficking?
One of the issues that breaks the heart of more people than any other issue is when children become involved in prostitution or sex trafficking. That is a preventable issue. That is an issue that if we support schools, support the children, support the court system in helping these kids have a stable life and get the education and skills that they need, that eliminates such a heartache in all of this. People who get involved with schools by volunteering, school districts who keep their eye on children, and when things are going amiss with kids, figure out how the community can get involved and support the children. We have a juvenile justice system here and extraordinary compassion within the judiciary about how to help kids. We have the ability to hook kids up with court advocates and businesses and help them learn new things. And I guess in my experience, and I've been working in this area since 1979, is that most of the time when just good people get involved and show kids what's possible with their lives, what they can have if they continue with school, what they can have in terms of jobs and future and dreams, and help them step by step access those goals, that's really, really happens.
Backtracking a bit, you've been involved with this issue for many, many years. What originally inspired you to become involved in combating human trafficking as a lawyer?
I decided to become a lawyer when I was 10, and I have a vivid memory of it. When I met my grandfather for the first time, and I was 19, I went to his house in La Jolla, and he had purchased a mail order bride who was my age for $50. That's $50 for her whole life, and he purchased her out of a little magazine called Cherry Blossoms Magazine. If you think back to 1979, that's when the laws against child abuse were emerging. Child abuse wasn't really even a crime in the 70s. It was more of a crime to beat your horse in Colorado than it was to kill a child. And there were two high-profile cases, the Elizabeth Manning case in Boulder, Colorado, and also the Stefan Thompson case. Stefan was a classmate of mine in high school, and he killed a two-year-old. Those two cases got our legislatures and our government moving in the direction of finding that cruelty to children was a solvable issue, and that we should put resources into it and change the law and start doing things. So all the things converged at that time. You know, I had decided to become an attorney. I saw what my grandfather had done, and I saw what was possible in the realm of child abuse, and I thought it should be expanded to support the dignity of all people.
How do people become victims of human trafficking?
Well, the biggest creator of human trafficking is war and destroyed economies. When you have an entire society displaced, for example, the former Soviet Union, there was nothing to eat. There was nothing to do. There was no money to be had. And so you had a huge migration of women and girls being sold into prostitution rings. And it was this question of survival. Same thing in Cambodia. When the Khmer Rouge were defeated by the Vietnamese and the country had been completely and utterly destroyed and the economies destroyed, people get involved in whatever it takes to live. You have people who sell their youngest kid so that the husband, the wage earner, the strong person in their family can get medical care so they can keep on going. These are just incredibly heart-wrenching dilemmas of humanity. We see in migrations now from Central America and Mexico, you have massive violence and people are fleeing from that. people are fleeing from complete violent and unsafe society and trying to form a life. And in doing that, there's no work for them along the way. What are they going to do to eat? I think that there will be a very large humanitarian crisis at the border, even larger than it is now, as more people try to come to a new place to start a new life and to have the freedoms and the abilities to make money. So war and displacement, violence, lack of safety, lack of rule of law, that's where the biggest parts of this come from in the world. In the United States, you know, we've looked at the issue from the side of why people buy, why men or women buy prostitutes or human trafficking victims. We looked at why people would ever want to be involved in that. Why would you want to be a pimp or a trafficker? Why girls get involved? Every side has its own story. What we know is that the largest piece of this is that when there are large populations of men, such as boom towns and oil towns or military bases, where there are men that don't have a lot going on societally, they don't have outside interests, they don't have sports, or maybe they're returning from war. That's when people want to use this as an escapism issue. Those problems can be addressed. And it's all about creating community around pockets of these places where there just isn't a great community going on and people create their own escapes.
Right. And on the Western Slope, you see income inequality. You have resort communities and you have agricultural communities. You have former mining towns. What climate does that create for this problem?
All I can say from my experience is that if people can't make a decent living, if people resort to opioids and other drugs as escape tools, that creates vulnerabilities and that creates the potential for this crime to occur.
What's it like working with survivors?
Well, it's challenging. I never really look at people as victims. I look at people on where they are in the time that they come. When I first meet somebody who's gone through this experience, whether it's torture, trafficking, any kind of hardcore exploitation that we work with, you know, people come and they've already made the first step to try to explore the possibility of what could happen for their lives. So my job really is to listen. It's to create legal solutions. It's to listen to my client wants those solutions to unfold and to create their future. Sometimes it's not even in the law. Sometimes writing their own book or helping them become an advocate or giving them their vision back to see what a great leader they were in the first place. You know, that's part of it. So it's a very creative process. It's a listening process and it's a partnership. And I will say, you know, when the people I've represented come out on the other side, it's always still a journey, just like anybody else. Life keeps going and there are always new things to learn. But every single person that I have worked with in this world has come out and done something extraordinary with their life. And I'm very proud of them, every single one of them.
How does Colorado compare to other states in terms of human trafficking?
Well, we're just human beings like every other state. We don't have, we're not L.A. or Miami or New York. So we don't have ports. We don't have, the numbers of people that other communities have. But humans are humans. And the problem exists, and it's just a matter of scale. Scales up depending on the population, scales down if there's less people. But still, it's here, and it's solvable here.
Is there anything that you think that people don't know or that would surprise them about human trafficking in Colorado?
First of all, I think people think that this is an exotic crime where people are smuggled in on Learjets and, something you might see in a movie. The reality is that most prostitution victims, human trafficking victims, are middle school girls from Denver Public School. They're generally, in that age, 14-ish, where there's a lot of confusion about their sexuality. They want to be loved. There's romance issues, and that is the point where kids are most vulnerable. And so I think that remains one of the most surprising things to me is when you drive by your middle school, that's where most of the kids are getting picked off. Supporting middle school kids is not easy. That is not an easy age group to work with. But working with them would make a lot of results in this area.
What message would you have for survivors of human trafficking?
Well, the first thing is that there's a lot of people who care about you, and you don't even know who they are, and they're out there. And there's two people in this room who really care. And I think that my message is you're not alone. And the other message is there's all possibility available to you. You can do anything you want. You've got skills, and you know things that other people do not know. You speak languages. You understand structures in different ways than other people do, and you can be extremely successful, So join up with some other people and figure out what else you can do. You can get on and have an amazing life that will astonish other people. You have the opportunity to have great relationships. You have the opportunity to have businesses, futures, family again, your children back. All of that is available. You just need to get out of your head and start taking steps forward.
That was lawyer Beth Klein speaking to reporter Zoe Rome about the underlying causes of human trafficking in Colorado and how community members can help solve the problem. Thanks for tuning in to Airtime on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. Each week, Airtime brings you conversations with the people and ideas that deserve a little more time. Today, you heard from reporter Zoe Rome. You can podcast or stream this show online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm Allison Bektesh. Thanks for listening. Airtime is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.